This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, November 5th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Politicians don't get much respect these days, nor do the advisors who tell them how to make themselves more popular. Here's Kent, the president's pollster on the HBO show Veep, talking to Ben, the president's chief of staff, and Amy, the vice president's chief of staff.
All I do is provide POTUS with the polls, cold numbers.
God, I hate numbers. I mean, there's cultures that don't even have any numbers, and they do just fine.
Well, Ben, it seems like you're ill-suited for your job, and you should resign.
Ben's breakdown aside, the VP feels we need a quick military strike here.
Yeah, precise and surgical, like your lobotomy, Ken.
Jill Lepore joins me to discuss the role that polling plays in American politics. So, Jill, we weren't always bombarded by poll numbers for the year leading up to presidential elections. How did we get to this point?
I had forgotten how recently it was that polls were so predominant in our coverage of elections. And the declining status of pollsters, as represented by Kent's unfortunate role in Veep, is also a fairly recent vintage. Pollsters used to be quite esteemed. You know, modern political polling began in the 1930s with George Gallup, who founded the American Institute for Public Opinion. Gallup was a kind of great cult figure, much applauded for his civic mindedness. People welcomed the public opinion poll in the 1930s as the most important step for democracy since the secret ballot.
Why would they think that?
They would think that for a number of reasons, mainly because Gallup so insistently told them that. Gallup was a great publicist. He really presented himself as a social scientist who was committed to the work of hearing the voices of Americans whose voices were not heard by the political process, and in the 1930s as a kind of great populist. And then social science was on the rise, and maybe in the way that, you know how the kind of free pass that people who are engaged in startups and who do STEM work, of the cultural cachet of the startup, in the 1930s that was social science. One of the things that that meant in the 1930s was that when Gallup's pollsters came to your door and knocked on the door, people answered. So Gallup's response rate, that is the percentage of people that took a soldier survey as a percentage of those who were asked, was well above 90. That is no longer the case.
You have a piece coming out in the magazine in a week or so where you argue that polling is actually teetering on the edge of disaster. Why is that?
From a technological vantage and a methodological vantage, there are a lot of problems with polling currently, mainly having to do with the transition from landlines to cell phones. More than 40% of Americans no longer have landlines, and the number of polling and market research organizations is so huge. The way the federal government, through the FCC, has tried to regulate that industry is by saying auto-random dialing of cell phones is against the law. So given that most Americans no longer have landlines, it's harder and harder for polling organizations to reach Americans. And the Americans who do not have landlines are somewhat different in demographic composition than Americans who do. Also, just people are sick of answering the phone and asking these questions. So the response rate, which, you know, started out in the 1930s above 90, is now in the single digits. What I'm really struck by, though, is that the problems with polls have been there all along, and they're not just the technological and methodological problems. They're fundamentally political problems.
And what do you mean by that? And how do pollsters defend themselves?
To be clear, what pollsters want to do is get the most accurate results and to report information that is reliable. So when Gallup devised the public opinion survey, though, he was really interested in finding out what Americans think. He was not that interested in predicting elections, which is actually a pretty dodgy proposition. But Gallup came to believe that it would be useful to use his method to forecast elections because it would prove the reliability of his opinion surveys. And what he was really selling were the results of his opinion surveys to newspapers as a product. He would report, you know, 40% of Americans believe this, that, or the other thing. And how can you prove that you're right? From Gallup's vantage, you would believe me if I used the same method to predict who was going to win the next presidential election. But it has all along been the case that there are problems with predicting elections. Critics said in the 1930s and 1940s, when Congress repeatedly investigated the polls and polling organizations, critics would say this interferes with the democratic process.
It's interesting, the statistician Nate Silver, he had a recent conversation on his website, 538.com, about the relative strengths of Donald Trump and Ben Carson, and he admitted that the real story is that there isn't all that much news in that campaign and the media is overinterpreting noisy data.
You know, I think what Nate Silver does is incredibly important and civic-minded. There is a barrage of polls out there. It's a sea of polls. And he tries to help people understand the relative merits of this poll or the other poll. But what you're suggesting Silver's remarks point to is an important consideration, and that is that actually the problem with polls hasn't to do with the pollsters. It actually has to do with the press.
Right. And so we're in a situation right now, about exactly a year from the election, candidates, reporters, pundits, voters, and pollsters, of course, we're all relying on what he calls the noisy data. And does it have a predictive power?
It's been shown not to have a predictive power. It's to the degree that it's data that has been analyzed, it's been analyzed to a negative result. The fact that they're not predictive is fairly well established. They're immensely entertaining.
They're also powerful, are they not? I mean, aren't now Republican candidates dropping out because the polls show nobody likes them?
Sure, absolutely right. So there's the problem. And there's so many polls, the responsibility is so low, and yet polls are wielding a far greater influence in American politics than ever before. There are candidates who have made decisions based on polls. There are people who donate money based on polls. All these polls we know, they're not actually telling us much, but they nevertheless are determining the course of the election.
This reminds me of a piece you wrote a couple of years ago. It seems part of this process of political consultants replacing party bosses, which is what we had in the mid-20th century. How did advertising and polling come to work together? As I recall, you used the example of Eisenhower's 1952 presidential campaign, which was kind of a turning point because of the advent of TV in many households.
One of the things that's so interesting about Gallup is the degree to which his work aligns with that of the first political consulting firm, which was called Campaigns Incorporated. And the people who found Campaigns Inc. come from the world of advertising. Gallup really comes from the world of newspaper circulation. These people are all bound up in the same set of forces, which is the application of the tools of social science, that is, using these quantitative methods to understand consumers. So what happens really beginning in the 1930s is the transformation of the workings of politics from a real party-driven system to a business model. And what's interesting about that to me is, you know, when you think about the 19th century American politics and how messy and sort of dirty politics was in the 19th century, and then you think about these heroic progressive reformers, these muckrakers who came in the 1890s and reformed the political machine and cleaned that system up. They introduced the secret ballot. There are all these, you know, incredibly important reforms to sort of kill the party machine. And then by the 1930s, it reemerges in a completely different form. It's in the form of public opinion management and political consulting. It's just a different machine.
And what about the 50s with the Eisenhower campaign and the advent of TV?
So Campaigns Inc. is still on the scene. By the 1950s, they introduced the first television campaign ads. They do opponent research. Most of the elements of modern political consulting, including the reliance on public opinion polls, those are all in place by 1952 when Eisenhower runs the sort of I Like Ike TV ads.
In 2008, Obama chose a different strategy, sort of shaming Karl Rove and all of the traditional political consultants. And his campaign was largely based on social media. How did that campaign change the way politicians woo voters?
There are tremendous effects to some of those changes to the reliance on social media. You know, there's this book called The Move On Effect. But there are a lot of careful political scientists who have urged that we be a little bit less gullible about the dramatic transformation that some of these technologies introduce. So there's this kind of interesting book called The Myth of Digital Democracy, which challenges the claims that the internet is essentially a democratic tool in the end. If by digital democracy we mean that more voices are heard, more words are spoken, but they're not heard. In fact, there's a real consolidation of political authority. I'm really fascinated by those developments. Things are like dazzlingly interesting. What if there are these little elves who are crawling the internet and telling us what people think, that we could find out what people think? But the more you kind of rush ahead with the technology, from my vantage, the less careful we attend to the deep humanistic questions involving political philosophy that have been asked from the very beginning about the very idea of public opinion, which is it a quantifiable thing? Is it something that does, in fact, lend itself to measurement of this sort? There's a set of assumptions about opinion and attitude that have never really been proven by behind the entire endeavor. And I think, given the role that polls have come to play, really ought to be asked and asked very, very carefully.
So how do you, as a writer and an American historian, analyze candidates and the issues? How do you go about sort of sifting through all of that and coming up with your arguments?
I think surveys that measure status or behavior have been proven to be fairly reliable. So the census is a very useful tool. It's not a sample survey, but it is a survey. Well, it's surveys that purport to measure opinion, where everybody involved in that work recognizes a fair amount of skepticism required. When you watch the last debate, maybe it was the second Republican debate, I followed this thing that Bing did, Pulse thing. There was a graph, like an EKG reading, that was going across your screen if you went to Bing. It was supposed to be like how everybody who was responding to Bing was responding second by second to things that the candidate said. And it has this eerie veneer of scientific truth, because here is this, it's also like the way it was visually represented, it just looks like something you'd see in an ER. And, it was Gallup who called polling, taking the pulse of the nation. And it was E.B. White who said, we should be careful if you take the pulse of the nation, that the nation just doesn't run up a flight of stairs. Really, it was really a visual manifestation of the idea that these tools are actually able to take in real time the pulse of the nation. And it was just about the most preposterous thing I had ever seen. And, I don't need to know that night who won the Republican debate. Making a political decision requires deliberation. And it requires conversation, and actually requires some notion of authority. So all of our opinions are not, in fact, equal. We haven't all thought about these issues. So the people who are responding second by second on the Bing pulse meter or whatever it is, they're not holding those opinions. They're evanescing those opinions. I guess I'm a great proponent for the idea that there's much less urgency to these matters than the press would make it appear. It's very important for the press to sell these polls as urgently, instantly necessary. We blame politicians all the time for the volatility and vehemence of our politics. But I think the press needs to be held a little bit more accountable for the way in which the embrace of volatility is a sales model.
Thank you so much, Jill.
Thank you.
Jill Laporte is a staff writer and a professor of American history at Harvard. She's the author, most recently, of The Secret History of Wonder Woman. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. This podcast is produced by Jill Dubuff and Alex Barron for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.
You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts in the iTunes Store. You can find past episodes of The New Yorker Out Loud, The Political Scene, and The New Yorker's fiction and poetry podcasts at NewYorker.com/podcast. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available at audible.com. This podcast is produced by Jill Dubuff and Alex Barron.